Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare and science in the news, and answers to your questions via email and also via the phone. And I'll be giving out the phone numbers in just a few minutes. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Let's start off with the story that really caught my eye this week. Sepsis is an extremely difficult issue. Researchers at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai say that tiny doses of a cancer drug may stop the raging, uncontrollable immune response to infection that leads to sepsis and kills up to 500,000 people a year in the United States. This one, my friend, goes near and dear to my heart because this is how my stepfather died a couple of years ago. Sepsis is caused by an excessive host response to infection in which the immune system runs amok and leads to multiple organ failure and death. It has an overall mortality rate of up to 50%. It's the 10th leading cause of death in the United States, killing more people than do HIV and breast cancer. The results from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai suggest that a therapy based on topoisomerase inhibition could save millions of people affected by sepsis, pandemics, and many other congenital deficiencies associated with acute inflammatory episodes, what is called a cytokine or a cytokine storm or an inflammatory storm. This topoisomerase inhibitors already exist and are used to treat cancer. There are other things besides sepsis where this could be extremely useful. There are new and brutal assaults on human immunity, such as what occur when you get a new influenza strain. Do you remember H1N1 in Mexico a few years back? Well, what made that so awful was that it was such a new-looking flu that the immune system just threw everything at it, so much, in fact, that the healthier you were, the young, healthy adults, the ones with the most potent immune systems, were the ones who died. And this is similar to what happened in the 1917 and 1918 flu epidemics, and it's similar to what happens with Ebola and other pandemics. So using these topoisomerase inhibitors, how do they work? Well, it's really quite interesting. They work in cancer because they prevent DNA from unwinding and replicating properly. So DNA is double-stranded. You have to unwind those strands and read one of them. And what the topoisomerase inhibitors do is they stop that from going smoothly, and you end up with tangled DNA, and the cell dies. Well, as cancer cells are much more vulnerable to this than normal cells. So if you get the dose right, you can kill colon cancer that's metastatic. You can kill ovarian cancer and lung cancer. And in fact, irinotecan and topotecan, two of the topoisomerase drugs we're talking about, have been used for exactly that. Now, from a chemotherapy standpoint, these drugs are difficult to give because they have to be given by slow infusion. But if you've got sepsis, you're already in the intensive care unit with about six lines going into your body. So the practical difficulties of administering these things don't exist. Furthermore, the doses that are required to treat sepsis are substantially smaller, about 1/50th of the dose that's needed to treat cancer. So we're talking about a low toxicity intervention, something that could be a real serious game changer in the world. And I'm certainly excited about that. I'm going to go to our first caller, and that is Eva in Kanab, Utah.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I cannot figure out, after reading and researching and thinking for really a long time, which is worse or better for you, soy milk or cow's milk, given that they're organic and non-GMO, both of them.
Okay, well, I think there's a lot of individual variation here, but I would, with one exception, which I'll get to in a moment, I would tend to come down in favor of the soy milk. And the downside about soy milk is it contains compounds that will interfere with your absorption of certain minerals. And it contains some protease inhibitors, which mean that you may not be able to absorb all of the protein that you're getting from the soy milk. So in our over-nutritioned, over-proteined world, I'm not so worried about not absorbing all the protein. As far as the not absorbing iodine is concerned, get some iodine supplementation if you're going to do soy milk every day. You know, take some extra iodine at a different time of day and you'll be fine. You'll compensate for that. If you're going to drink milk, my recommendation is it be fermented. So this is in the form of yogurt or cheese. And the reason is, in the process of fermenting, some of the growth factors that are present in milk that have been, you know, indirectly, but I think fairly substantially associated with cancer risk, are alleviated. And we're talking about organic milk. So it's the cancer risk thing has to do with the fact that if you have a small cancer, it's a race between your immune system and the cancer. And if you're taking growth factors that stimulate growth, and you're an adult, the thing that you're going to stimulate growth of, at least theoretically, is cancer. The cancers that are in your body that are basically sitting out there with receptors on their surfaces waiting for a growth signal, because cancers are mostly expressing embryologic DNA, and embryologic DNA includes these growth receptors on the surface of the cell. So you see, epidemiologically, we do see dairy consumption as a cancer risk, but there's lots of intervening variables, and I'm not trying to say that milk causes cancer. What I'm saying is, at worst, milk may make cancers grow faster, and we don't know the dose, but the data suggests that the fermenting process gets rid of whatever those growth factors are. So I hope I haven't been too complicated there for you. The exception to this...
What about soy milk or soy in general contributing to breast cancer?
That is a statement that is why I said I would get back to the one exception. So if you're postmenopausal and you had breast cancer in the last decade, you probably should stay away from soy. And that is the only circumstance where I would say stay away from soy. And that is because if you're postmenopausal and you've had breast cancer in the last 10 years, you're probably not on hormone replacement therapy. So you don't have any estrogen, or not much, floating around in your bloodstream to latch onto estrogen receptors on your breast cancer cells that might be lurking in the bone marrow or lurking somewhere else in your body. And so you don't want to stimulate those guys into growth. And in the environment where there is no other estrogen, that's where soy can act as a ligand. In other words, it can fit onto the receptor. But if there's actually estrogen around, then soy actually blocks the estrogen receptor, because the thing about these receptors is it's not like putting a key in the lock, although I often use that metaphor. Some keys will stimulate that receptor 10 or 100 times harder than others. And so if you have estrogen sitting on the receptor and it stimulates it at a rate of, let's say, 1, if you've got soy on that receptor and that stimulates it at a rate of 1, if you had estrogen on that receptor, it would stimulate it at a rate of 100. So in that circumstance, if there's estrogen being produced by the ovaries, there's clear evidence that soy is protective against breast cancer. And it's
what if you're an old lady and you have no estrogen and you're not taking any hormones?
Well,
you haven't had breast cancer.
If you haven't had breast cancer, I don't think it's a problem, because I don't think stimulating the estrogen, I don't think there's any data at all anywhere, and I challenge anybody to show me some, that the levels of estrogenic stimulation that you're going to get from soy are in vivo, which is to say in your body, come anywhere near, first of all, it isn't going to cause cancer. That's not the mechanism that estrogen causes cancer. There's a completely different mechanism for that. So it's only capable of doing anything bad if you already have a cancer and you have no estrogen. And then maybe you could have a problem. So that's why I'm saying 10 years, because if you haven't awakened your breast cancer, if it's been silent for 10 years, then I just think that you could get by with eating a little soy without getting, you know, into any kind of trouble. All right. These are opinions. They're science-based, and they're also rationally based, looking at strengths and weaknesses of the various foods. But if you asked me about cow's milk versus soy, and what I'm saying is I think cow's milk is more likely to stimulate something you don't want to stimulate than soy milk is, except in that breast cancer situation.
All right. Hey, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thank you from way out there in Utah. Appreciate your call.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye. All right. Well, we're going to take a moment and let's see. I need to turn on mic 3 and welcome Bonnie Jean
to the
mix. Hello, Bonnie Jean.
Dr. Don, I just learned something today. That was fascinating. I know how to steer my milk consumption needs now. So thank you for that. And that's the kind of information you get from Dr. Don's show every week. What a tremendous community service you serve, not just here in the Monterey Bay Area, but also to anyone listening to this signal at KUSP.org or at 88.9 KUSP FM.
Let's go to our first email, and this from Dr. Martha P., and I hope I get your name right, Francescato, in San Rafael. And I put her name out there because she gave it to us. Statins and red yeast rice. Dear Dr. Don, I would be grateful if you could tell me how you feel about red yeast rice. I know it's a supplement, but the chemical statins are derived from it. Do you think it's safe? Thanks so much. So, Martha, this is a really interesting story. Actually, red yeast rice goes back to Chinese medicine, Chinese herbal medicine. It's been around for centuries and known to help with cardiac disease, which I think is fascinating, which means that way before the cholesterol hypothesis, the astute observers that created Chinese medicine the way that the ancients created astronomy, by paying attention and taking notes, those astute observers said, this seems to have an effect on heart disease. Quite a bit later, Merck and company comes along and they are looking at fungi, they're looking at bacteria, and they're looking for new drugs, because most of the drugs that we use were stolen from the microbiological kingdom. They were things that were made by other organisms that have activity in the human body. And statins are no exceptions. Lovastatin, the first statin, was derived from one of the monocolins. These are compounds that are found in red yeast rice, monocolin K. And monocolin K became lovastatin and became patented. And then many years later, there was a herbal product called Colestin, which actually was red yeast rice where they had augmented the monocolin K. And Merck took them to court and said, this is our patented drug, and you can't use it, except, of course, it actually grows on rice and is a fermentation product of a yeast. But that doesn't matter. We went and we were allowed by the U.S. Patent Office to patent it. So now guess what? You can't use it. Well, it turns out that the FDA said, nope, you can't augment the monocolin A. And then a few years later, the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine did a study using regular plain old garden variety red yeast rice, no augmented monocolin. And you know what? It still works just as well as lovastatin, maybe a bit better than Lipitor. It lowers cholesterol from 10 to 33% across the population range. So red yeast rice works. It does contain compounds that resemble statins, and it probably contains compounds that actually buffer the monocolin A that it does contain, because you get a lowering of cholesterol, but you don't get as many side effects. You can get the side effects, and so they need to be monitored for. I always ask my patients on red yeast rice, you know, are you getting muscle cramps? Are you getting brain fog? You know, please be careful with grapefruit and, you know, the known drug interactions like some of the antifungals. We tell them that, and we watch for it. But professionally, I've been using this compound in people who had bad reactions to statins for over 15 years at this point, and particularly in the last 5 years. I've been using it a lot, and I've given it numerous times to patients who had muscle pain or brain fog with statins, and they don't have that reaction with the monocolins, and we do get a big improvement in their cholesterol, just as big as what we had when they were on the pharmaceuticals. Now, Fair Advisory. I am also coaching them on diet and getting them to exercise and doing lifestyle change, which is the fundamental way you fix cholesterol, not just giving people another pill. And, you know, that is the key. But in those situations where you need to use an intervention, this is an effective intervention. Going to take a moment and give out those phone numbers for your phone calls with questions. They are 476-2800, 1-800-655-5877. 476-2800, 1-800-655-5877. And reaching out to our business supporter community, we want to give you a big thank you. KUSP is supported by Well Within Spa, celebrating 29 years of relaxing Santa Cruz, offering massage therapy, face and body care, and private spa rooms overlooking a Japanese garden. Information available at 458-WELL or wellwithinspa.com. And the members of our business circle. Thank you to Loudoun Integrative Pharmacy and Kumbwa Jazz Center and Universal Audio and to Ed Sigourney's Tractor Service for their support. And I'm going to take a moment and just add to that and say to the business community who's out there, I'm a small business person. I'm reaching out to the other small business owners. Please support KUSP with a one-time grant or contribution. This is a moment where you can really, really make a difference. And I want to read just a quick story here. Very cool magic science. In the not-too-distant future, implanted medical devices may make their own electricity. Researchers have perfected a set of electrodes made from materials that are compatible with the human body and are able to oxidize blood glucose and turn it into fuel. Now, these are polymeric and carbonaceous materials for energy generation, and they need to figure out how to hook it into a battery so that they could store the energy. But we may be entering the era where your pacemaker is powered by your blood sugar, and there's no need to open you up and replace that battery every year or two, as is the current situation for people with pacemakers. This could open up the possibility of all sorts of deep body implants, replacing organs or augmenting organs. We are really entering a brave new world of science and medicine, and I hope that you will stay with us and join us as we continue on this journey. Well, now we're going to talk about, well, the whole show is actually a lot about genetics, and the next part is Bonnie's live because I've really enjoyed having a dialogue with Bonnie last time.
I get pretty curious about what you're talking about. Sometimes I have questions.
Yeah, it's cool. Okay, so at least 15% of genetic diseases are not due to DNA mutations encoding DNA. So it's not a mistwisted protein. We always think about it.
It's a mutation or something.
A mutation in the DNA means that when the ribosomes transcribe the RNA, there's a different protein, maybe a positive charge instead of a negative charge. And because proteins twist up like a little chain of magnets, mm-hmm. then you get a different twist, and now the protein doesn't work as well. Maybe the enzyme doesn't work as well, or maybe the collagen is softer, so you have Marfan syndrome. You know, that's how those genetic diseases work.
Okay.
But it turns out that at least 15% of genetic diseases are actually mutations in the non-coding part.
Well, how does that even work?
Exactly. Thank you. See, that's why I like having you around. How does that even work?
How can there be mutations in the non-coding part?
The non-coding DNA turns out to be critical for affecting transcription and splicing. So if you have a mutation in the start signal mm-hmm. of the DNA, then the gene doesn't get transcribed. Bad. But there's also editing and cutting and pasting instructions that are included in the DNA around the protein gene. Mm-hmm. And these coding instructions affect what the messenger RNAs, or how they're going to get spliced. Because effectively, the RNA comes off of the DNA and then gets cut and pasted into a different configuration. Now, you've probably heard the statistic about how DNA, how we only have 30,000 genes, and yet lower animals, complex, higher life forms only have 30,000 genes, but worms have 150,000 genes.
Oh, well, that's counterintuitive.
It's terribly counterintuitive. And the reason is our DNA is actually so much more sophisticated
Oh, I see.
That we have a single let's say we have a single line of 100 codons.
We're packing in more per DNA.
And we're actually cutting that, taking that protein and saying, oh, this is a good front end that twists to the right. Mm-hmm. And here we have a middle thing that does this. But if we chop out half of this middle, then it does something completely different, fits into a different receptor. And the back end twists the other way. So we're going to use the same front end, the same black back end, but we're going to splice the center. Huh. Tweak that, put the whole thing together, run it through the ribosome, and you end up with two completely different proteins, maybe with similar end groups, so they both sit on the cell membranes. They're labeled to kind of like email, you know, you put the address on the front,
yeah,
and it goes to a certain box.
Uh-huh.
But if you might send multiple things to that box, and that box could be the cell membrane. So this is being, so the address part's the same.
Uh-huh.
On the front end, okay. But the information in the center is different.
Okay.
And so we're constantly cutting and pasting and editing the messenger RNA before it even gets to the protein production factory as a blueprint to be turned into a protein. And we know as it comes out as a single string of beads that immediately starts twisting on itself.
Mm-hmm.
And the order that the beads come out determine how it twists. And then the charges on, as you get this sort of coiling up ball of protein, mm-hmm. where the charges are, if you've got a whole bunch of positive charges, if the next thing coming out is a string of negatives, it's going to slap to those positive charges and twist the other way. So you can, in fact, create all kinds of different shapes by just cutting and pasting the center of the protein transcription apparatus.
So does that mean that depending on how you cut and paste or when those things stick, the order of the string can be different?
Is key. So think about sickle cell anemia.
Okay.
So what happens in sickle cell is you have a leucine to valine. So you have one little genetic blip. And so instead of getting an amino acid called leucine, you get an amino acid called valine. Mm-hmm. The charges are different on them. So when you get to a low oxygen environment, the hemoglobin protein actually changes its shape. It snaps into a different configuration in a low oxygen environment, an acidic environment, in other words.
So the environment in which that editing happens matters also.
At the editing, it's silent until the pH of the blood changes. So even though the protein is acting like normal healthy hemoglobins, doing what it's supposed to do, grabbing oxygen, holding onto it, and then when you get into a low oxygen tension environment, in other words, high pH,
okay.
The protein's shape shifts because the pH affects the shape. It turns into a sword and actually cuts open the red blood cell.
Whoa.
So it snaps. It's like a transformer. It transforms from a truck to a robot, right?
Ta-da.
Well, it transforms into a sword, slices open the cell. The cell basically breaks and you get all of the release of this hemoglobin into the bloodstream, which A, it's extremely painful, and B, little cellular swords floating around, you can imagine.
Yeah.
And B, it'll clog up your kidneys. And basically, it's a horrible disease. The reason that it's still in the human genome is because if you've got one copy of this bad DNA, you are very untasty to the malaria parasite.
Oh.
So it protects you against malaria. But in a low and so even though it'll kill
so
you
it's good
a
in
little,
most environments.
Yeah,
then
get pneumonia or get sick, start, you know, have nausea and vomiting for 2 days, drop your blood pH, and now you're in sickle cell crisis.
Oh.
But that doesn't happen often enough to help, basically to overwhelm the survival value of having that DNA. So we never know which genes are good and which genes are bad.
Yeah, I was just saying, well, can't we just eliminate the baddies and then there we're good?
Well, but in a different context,
right,
that might be good. In fact, going back to the sea otters that I was talking about earlier, part of the problem for the sea otters is that 50 individuals. So those sea otters are actually very vulnerable to a disease called Toxoplasma gonadii. In fact, 68% of the dead otters that wash up on the shores are infected with that parasite. Guess where it comes from? Domestic cats.
Oh,
remember the thing about
the cat litter or whatever.
The cat litter, pregnant ladies can get it. Fetus, it can cause birth defects. So pregnant ladies aren't supposed to.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? People flush their cat litter down the toilet. It doesn't come out when it goes through the waste treatment plant.
Yeah.
And so as a result, there's tons of toxoplasma in the Monterey Bay. So by the way, folks, if you like otters, don't flush your kitty litter. You know,
kind of don't do it anyway.
Put it in a bag, put it in the landfill. It's all good, but don't flush it down the toilet. And the whole thing about this last dialogue that we just had was it was a wonderful little wander along with the old, like the old PBS series by James Burke called Connections, where you just start in one place and wander all over history.
Yeah, we wound up back at the sea otters.
So we wound up back at the sea otters, which is exactly what we like to do. We like to bring it back and bring it back to you.
Wow. So, okay. So I don't suppose there's anything people can do about that 15% of mutations that happen because of the editing process that you were talking about.
Well, what we can do is to try and avoid getting mutated. So if you are, once the mutation occurs in the germline, we're kind of stuck with it. There's now a hereditary disease. But you and I are both growing vital, replacing our cells, and during the period that the DNA is unwound and building a new cell, that's when we're vulnerable to oxidative stress. That's why too much sun causes skin cancer. That's why people who have high stress, high psychological stress, get more cancer, is because the biological effects of high chronic stress are actually creating free radicals. Free radicals are like little sparks that fly through our cells, and if they happen to hit a piece of DNA that's open, it sizzles, and you've got a mutation. Because during the repair process, it's kind of, do I put a C in here, or do I put a T in here, or do I put a G in here? And depending on what the cell decides to do, what the repair apparatus decides to do, you got a new mutation. If you get too many mutations in a cell, it's potentially a cancer cell. And if the environment's right, low oxygen tension, low oxygen tension, a whole bunch of host factors, many of them dietary, it's turning out, like those growth factors we were talking about in the soy. It's kind of a perfect storm. If all the moments are right, then you can get a cancer going. And it happens all the time. And 99.9% of the time, the immune system catches the error, kills the cancer clone before it gets rolling. Every now and then, that doesn't happen. And then we're in damage control mode, big time in medicine, trying to shift the intracellular and extracellular environment, but primarily intracellular. We're only now just beginning to focus on that extracellular environment.
Oh, boy. So everyone, eat your veggies.
Eat your veggies. Do your meditation.
Yeah.
Eat your veggies. Do your meditation. Seriously, that's core. That's core. And not too much. Not too much booze. Not too much pot. Marijuana smoking, particularly, it's the burning. It's the burning. The burning is not good, folks. So just keep that in mind. Bonnie, I pulled this one out because it's also about RNA and its importance. And this is, we talked about how genes get spliced, when that non-coding DNA is also really important for how genes fire. So during fetal development, hundreds of genes turn on and off together to build the brain. MicroRNAs are the non-coding portion of the genome, and each of the, and there are special microRNAs that control 100 or more different genes and basically switch them on at the right moment to have the neurons develop properly, and then switch them off again at just the right moment. Now, what they're finding is that schizophrenia, a disease known to be hereditary, is not due to a single gene. And when we started decoding the DNA, this really was like, well, what's up with that? There's like all these different genes, and they're on different chromosomes, and how can they be linked? And the answer is microRNAs. So microRNAs actually turn on and off different suites of genes.
Okay.
And schizophrenia is a microRNA disease. It's a failure of the controller to grow the brain and let the, and the neurons actually migrate through the brain. They start in one place, they migrate, they hook up with different neurons that started in a different place. And if those hookups don't happen correctly, you get disordered thought patterns that don't manifest for until puberty. Most people, there's childhood schizophrenia is generally a disease of adolescence.
Right, right.
And schizophrenia, if anyone who, and everyone has seen a person with schizophrenia, you can see that the brain is just not firing right. And having many patients with schizophrenia who, when they're taking their medications, are perfectly rational, perfectly appropriate, firing on all cylinders individuals. But if the medications, if they run out of medication or for any reason it's not available to them think earthquake, think homelessness, mm-hmm. then they are just like that computer that won't work. That everything is just scrambled, and
the microRNA aren't available or capable of turning on and off their.
Basically, what the medications do is they turn on. What the medications do is they slow down certain neurons, so that things are in. So that things are in tune. Think of an orchestra where half the orchestra is playing on the upbeat and the other half's playing on the downbeat. It's total cacophony. But if you can get them all agreeing on what one is, mm-hmm. so now everybody's doing 1, 2, 3, 4 with the same 1, 2, 3, 4, then you've got a working brain,
right,
or a working orchestra.
Wow. So, I mean, just really subtle things can have just a massive effect on the body.
And that is absolutely the case. And it's very complicated. And so there's this hierarchy that we're just beginning to understand how many nested feedback loops there are. So there's like gears, big gears, little gears, mm-hmm. and then the gears are stacked, and then there's connections between each stack mm-hmm. that changes the rate of the gears in the other stack.
And they have to meet up at the right the right sequence.
Exactly.
Right,
and it's all variable so that the organism can adapt to changing circumstances. So that, it's kind of like my robot vacuum cleaner, you know, it has very simple set of commands, but I can stick it to the top of the stairs and it won't fall down the stairs. I always find that fascinating. It gets up to the edge and goes, oh, that's not right, and backs up. And it's got that robot vacuum cleaner is a little stupider than the stupidest bacteria.
Yeah.
Okay. It's got a very, very small behavior set, mm-hmm. but in trying to create autonomous entities like the self-flying drone or whatever else is the current hot geek speak thing. in trying to create that, what we are doing is replicating, at least in terms of its function and the systems involved, something that nature has already invented beautifully, something that nature grew over millions of years that is elaborate and complex and incredibly beautiful. And we now begin to have the tools to actually see it. We're at that moment when the microscope just got invented. Our ability to look at genes, our ability to look at proteins, look at the RNA that's being made, and see it in the body dynamically. This is like a microscope or a telescope. It's Hubble. It's bigger than Hubble. It's huge.
So another magnitude of focus and ability to see the small, subtle, interconnected systems that make us us.
Right. And the big tool that we have, our major computing capacity, without that, we could not wrap our humble little brains around this complexity.
Oh, yeah.
But the big supercomputers can do it. And they think differently than we do, and they can look at things over and over again very fast, right? That's what mm-hmm. these big computers do.
Right.
And so they can build a structure that we can then look at and recognize the patterns in. Once the structure's been built, then once we recognize the patterns, then we can test that idea. We can poke at it. We have the tools to manipulate the DNA. We have CRISPR. We can just do a spot edit. We can cut and paste. I mean, we can edit the genetics, and then we can experiment on it and see, what does that do? Does that fix it? Does it make it worse? What if we take this out? What happens then? Mm-hmm. And it allows us to test our ideas about how the system is working, and it allows us to patch things, to manipulate and change things. And we are so close to identifying some fundamental life-transforming changes. I am so wanting to continue to be here and be able to talk about this. This story is a good example, real quick.
Okay.
A major breakthrough. There are 9 drugs that you can give to a stem cell, and it will turn into a brain cell, or it'll differentiate into a brainstem cell, and then it will differentiate into 3 main types of brain cells, which are neurons, astrocytes, and oligodendrocytes. It will actually turn into brain cells. 9 drugs that are FDA approved that exist. Same thing for a heart. So you can take a skin cell, a fibroblast. Mm-hmm. You can mutate it back to a pluripotent stem cell. You can then give it another set of drugs. Total is 9, and now it's a heart cell.
Wait, so we can take just Joe cell, any kind of cell.
Scrape the skin,
for instance, and turn that skin cell into a stem cell that mm-hmm. we can then reroute into whatever else we want to build.
Proof of concept so far for cardiac Whoa. Muscle and proof of concept for neuron. And so the idea here is we may be able to do this in vivo. In other words, we may be able to get to the point where we can give something that's non-toxic that will cause you to grow new brain cells or fix your broken heart. Your heart that just had a massive heart attack and the front wall of it is now scar tissue. We're seeing it in mice. Mm-hmm. We've got they're working on it in in mammals basically right now, small mammals, mm-hmm. because this is difficult to do. If you can do it in a mouse, you can probably do it in a person. That's really what we have established as proof of concept in drug development.
That's been true in medicine science.
It's been drug and medicine for a while.
Yeah.
So if we can do it in a mouse, we can do it in a person, and we are so close to this. I want to be here giving everybody the latest lowdown, making sure that we put it into terms where it doesn't just blow past your ear because you don't understand the big picture. Mm-hmm. So you can understand how this fits into the big picture. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.